the war against monuments to Cecil John Rhodes in particular. Tonight on the Reformation Society, we are in a city which is overlooked by Rhodes Memorial, which has been a target for people who hate our history. A magnificent venue. I'm sure many of us have gone there for all kinds of reasons. The war against historic monuments has now resulted in the decapitation of the bust of Cecil John Rhodes at Rhodes Memorial on the slopes of Devil's Peak in the Cape Peninsula, Sunday, the 12th of July, 2020. Rhodes Memorial offers an unparalleled panoramic view of the Cape Peninsula, and many of us have taken guests. The first thing we do when they come here is we take them up to Rhodes Memorial, that they can get a view of the Cape Flats and the whole of the Hottentots Holmes spread out there. You can actually see on the one side Table Bay, and the other side, if you lean out a bit more, you can see even the False Bay. And sometimes you can actually see the orange of sunset, the white of the clouds, and then the blue of the mountains like the old Arunya Blunya Blow. And at night, well, we used to be able to go there at night, and I had many a first date going up to Rhodes Mem. And I even climbed up the top of the horse one time once I got up top there thinking, this is very high, how am I going to get down again? Rhodes Memorial is often a site for wedding photographs and film shoots, and a very popular venue for all kinds of shoots and family pics. The Matthew film utilized Rhodes Memorial for the temple scenes, and I must say I think it was one of the most magnificent of all of the Jesus films. As far as the temple scenes go, they did it really well. Rhodes Memorial has often been a site for Easter Sunday sunrise worship services, and sitting on those steps and seeing the sunrise of the Hottentots in the morning as they sing Up From the Grave Heroes. Many happy memories with Salvation Army band playing. Surprisingly, even President Nelson Mandela publicly praised the vision and educational legacy of Cecil John Rhodes. At a speech at Rhodes University in Grahamstown on the 16th of April 2002 on the centenary of the death of Cecil John Rhodes, Nelson Mandela emphasized the need to honor and respect those who've worked to build and develop our country, which included Cecil John Rhodes as one of the most prominent. Well, one of the most prominent. In fact, I'd like to ask someone who built this country more, especially Cape Town. Is there any individual who did more for the people of Cape Town than Cecil John Rhodes in history? Well, still quoting from Nelson Mandela, South Africa belongs to all who live in it, united in our diversity. We have to harness all of the different strands of a history as we reconstruct and develop our country. We have to ensure, said Mandela, that we live together in ways that make all South Africans confident that the country equally belongs to all who live in it. And he said this specifically on the anniversary, the centenary of the death of Cecil John Rhodes, to honour Cecil John Rhodes for all that he had done, particularly in terms of education for this country. And Mandela even said all of his education, Mandela's education, primary, secondary, tertiary education, he got as a result of Cecil John Rhodes's trust and legacy and investment in education. The Rhodes Scholarship, in fact, so impressed Nelson Mandela that he attached his name to it, which is a little presumptuous because he didn't put much investment in it. He was basically adding his name to that of Rhodes, but that's interesting because there's all these people who claim Nelson Mandela as a god, but they hate Cecil John Rhodes. Well, interesting disconnect there, because you can go to Rhodes's cottage and see Cecil John Rhodes's legacy is honored even at Rhodes's cottage by Nelson Mandela, saying how much in debt he was to Cecil John Rhodes. And the Rhodes Scholarship is one of the most sought after and respected scholarships in the world. So in damaging this historic monument, which was erected by the donations of citizens of Cape Town, financed by individual donations, totally voluntary donations, these vandals are guilty of a serious crime. They're also publicly demonstrating their ignorance of what Cecil John Rhodes actually stood for and what he actually achieved, and also showing the ignorance of what Nelson Mandela advocated in respecting those who built the country and who developed it for the benefit of all. And whether we like Cecil John Rhodes or not, he benefited us all and developed it a lot. And yet, one of the most irresponsible examples of pathetic journalism I've ever seen in my life was in the southern suburbs of Tatla just the week later. 23rd of July, Rhodes Memorial vandal praised. Can you imagine a more irresponsible journalistic headline, the front cover of a so-called independent newspaper? And a cry for help from the long-suffering. What a lot of nonsense. In fact, we have evidence that the person who did this was a white person in the name of black people. This is typical. BLM in America is founded by whites, and 70% of them in BLM are white, and it's all white liberals running this whole show. You go to the Black First, Land First, and the Land Party, it's all run by white liberals who are radical communists and so on, and they are using black people as a front for their agenda, which is nothing but Marxist. But what a lot of absolute nonsense, and they came up with a name of the Black People National Crisis Committee, which is a total invention of a white woman. But anyway, nevertheless, this is the kind of nonsense. As an editor, I know that you have a choice of what articles you print, what title you use, what goes on the front, what's in the first paragraph, what's in the last paragraph, what subtitles you use. And an editor who chooses to quote an anonymous source of an organization nobody's ever heard of before on the front page in the first paragraph, this is propaganda. This is not news. Well, who was Cecil Rhodes? Why is he a target? And why does South African National Parks Board have to clean up the mess that irresponsible people make afterwards? It is, after all, part of the national parks. When Cecil Rhodes died in 1902, all of Cape Town seemed to turn out for the funeral procession. He was one of the most respected people in Cape Town's history, if not the most. And when arriving in Bulawayo, the funeral procession Bulawayo, which is where I grew up, for him was evidently showing the respect of all concerned. And it didn't take long until they had monuments being unveiled to him all over Rhodesia, which you would expect, and in Kimberley, which you'd also expect, because nobody had done more to develop Rhodesia or Kimberley or Cape Town. This is the monument in Kimberley. Has Cecil Rhodes very appropriately on his horse with a map in hand, and he's charting out the development of the city. And well, he's the one who first saw the need to consolidate the diamond fields, and Kimberley certainly would rate him as their first citizen. And so the people of Cape Town had a idea of how to honor the memory of Cecil Rhodes, and so they even considered building a colossus. Now, you might recall that one of the seven man-made wonders of the ancient world was the Colossus of Rhodes, the island of Rhodes. It was a colossal statue which stood astride the actual entrance to the harbor. Unfortunately, an earthquake brought it down, so it doesn't exist anymore. But they wanted to build a Colossus of Rhodes on Signal Hill. Can you imagine? I'm glad they chose rather to build this far more tourist-friendly and pleasant venue up on the slopes of the mountain. And here they are in the process, and you can just imagine the hard work it took to build this up. And here you have a newspaper article in Britain on Table Mountain near Cape Town. By the way, can I just remind you of that? Rondebosch is near Cape Town. It's not Cape Town. I was not born in Cape Town. I was born in Pinelands. And Pinelands was its own city, and Rondebosch was its own city, and so was Mowbray. And nobody, when I was born, and even when I was a man in my 20s, would have called Rondebosch Cape Town. I mean, Cape Town's that place just in front of Table Mountain, by Table Bay. People in Sea Point were not in Cape Town. People in Camps Bay weren't in Cape Town. And people in Belleville certainly weren't in Cape Town. And neither was Wynberg Cape Town. Those were different areas. And Rondebosch Fountain was halfway between Cape Town and Wynberg, where the military base was, and that's why we had a fountain there for the horses to refuel en route. And just notice that this mentality now that Rondebosch is Cape Town is just part of this unicity fraud that's being foisted on us by the globalists who want centralization of everything to destroy the individual identity of all different aspects. So what they have to say here is how Cecil John Rhodes devoted his life to furthering the interests of his mother country in Africa. He left a fortune acquired in South African diamond mines to found the Rhodes Scholarships at Oxford University, enabling young men, well actually, and women, from various countries, including the United States, to pursue advanced studies in England. Here you see the Girl Guides gathering for a memorial at the Rhodes Memorial, and This is a magnificent site, and I might say that I did a lot of my studies when I was at Baptist Theological Seminary on the slopes here, just about in front of that tree. I was fed up with being forced not to be in a field and having to be in a classroom so much, and in the fire brigade at night. So I used to do my studies and set work books and lying on the grass. And at that stage, there was no wall on the side there. And so the buck were all around here, and I would soon have the deer lying all around me. And I got so friendly with them, they got so comfortable with me, that I could lie with my head on a deer while I was reading my books and doing my assignments. And so I've got many happy memories of Rhodes Moyle as a magnificent place to get a bit of sunshine and be in the outdoors in front of a panorama of Cape Town. Now, you may wonder, why 49 steps up the monument? Anyone tell me? 49 steps? He lived for 49 years, just 49 years, from 1953 to 1902. Good training, running up and down those steps. And you can see why they would have chosen this venue for filming films like the Matthew film on the temple. The immense and brooding spirit still shall quicken and control. Living he was the land, and dead his soul shall be her soul. Speaking about the fact that the philosophy of education in the classroom in this generation becomes a philosophy of government in the next generation. A man old before his time, a physically sick man, a man who was sent to Africa to die in his teens. They didn't expect him to live so long. He always had this sense of urgency that he had to do things fast because he knew his days were short and he didn't know how many months, let alone years, that he had ahead. And so that's why he was always in a rush. And the lions, understandable. You've got these eight magnificent regal lions on the side because everything he did was for adding land to the empire of Queen Victoria. But aside from the lions, you get the horse, energy. The work of G.F. Watts, and given him to the genius of Cecil Rhodes. So energy, this energetic man on a horse galloping away, this is meant to symbolize the energetic genius of Cecil Rhodes galloping ahead, trying to, in the service of the lions of the British Empire. And what a magnificent view you get from there. Cecil Rhodes was greatly respected by the Matabele, whose culture he respected. And, you know, on the mines, he was respected the most because he learnt Zulu, and therefore he could also speak Matabele. He spoke to the mine workers, who were many times Zulu or Matabele in their own language. He paid them in advance, unlike any of the others. They trusted him, and he was known as their advocate on the mines in Kimberley and solved many a problem that way. And during the war with the Matabele, he walked out unarmed into the midst of the Matabele during a war and had them sit down, had an indaba, brought peace. The Matabele loved and respected him. When King Lobengula died, his sons, the princes of the kingdom of Matabeleland, chose to be the servants of Cecil Rhodes to end of his life. They served him. They served him as the new king of the Matabele. The Matabele honored Cecil Rhodes with a traditional king's burial and bayete salute in the Matopos, where for over 80 years they posted warriors to guard and protect his gravesite and wall and make sure everyone who went there respected the grave of Cecil John Rhodes. And here you can see some people visiting, an old pith helmet, and there's a Matabele standing with his knob carry to ensure that you respect the grave of Cecil John Rhodes. That was his choice, worldview. He wanted to be at worldview because, he called it worldview because you could see so far then in the Matopas, not far from Bulawayo. I went there many a time and hiked up and down there. Once when I was visiting there on a mission, this is in the 1980s, and my brother was with me, and my brother got separate from me, and as I was coming down from it, I came under fire. I mean, gunshots being fired at me. It was my brother playing a joke on me. I mean, he literally was firing live rounds over my head to see how I'd react in the ambush. That's what elder brothers do sometimes, it seems. When in February 2012, ZANU-PF Marxists attempted to exhume Rhodes' remains, the local chief Masuku forbade it. Godfrey Mashe, one of Zimbabwe's foremost archaeologists, strongly opposed this desecration of an historic monument and a tourist attraction. And in fact, the Matabele in that area said, this is the grave of one of our kings. So to them, you just don't touch it. Not even Mugabe dead. By the way, you'll notice on Rhodes' instructions, a monument to the memory of the Shangani Patrol in a distance sharing that site. The Shangani Patrol was Alan Wilson's brave patrol of just 40 men who fought to the end against the Matabele, the only defeat I can think of that won a war. They got cut off from the main group. They were scouting ahead. The river swelled, the Shangani River, overnight, and they found themselves facing 3,000 Matabele warriors, top-class warriors. I mean, the Matabele were Zulu, who had migrated north, and so these are the best warriors Africa had ever seen. And they fought and fought and fought, and after a long time, there was silence, and the Induna came, he saluted Alan Wilson, his patrol, said, "You are brave men, you can go, you can take your wounded, you can take your dead, you can take your horses, you're free to go," and they parted. And Alan Wilson responded, "White men do not retreat." So they saluted again, they continued the fight until every one of them was dead. And at the end, the Matabele came into Bulawayo, where the forces of Jameson, Leander Stott Jameson, the first administrator of Rhodesia, after whom Jameson Hall is named up at University of Cape Town, Jameson was preparing to evacuate because they lost this battle and expected a counterattack, and in came the Matabele warriors to surrender. And Leander Stott Jameson asked the Induna, "Why are you surrendering after you've won a battle?" They said, "These men were men of men, and their fathers were men before them. They fought like lions. If these youngsters could fight so strong, what's going to happen when their fathers come for revenge? We want peace now." And that was the end of the war. The war ended with a defeat for the Rhodesians, but they won the war. And so Cecil Rhodes insisted that they be buried on the Matopos with a monument where he would later be buried too. Interesting. And it is a magnificent view. It's a breathtaking view to be up there in the Matopos. Now, it's unlikely that the hysterical mobs and destroyers of historic monuments are aware of any of this. That they are merely pawns in a cheap political move may be the furthest thing from their minds, but damaging historic monuments and tourist attractions are not only meaningless gestures that will do nothing good to improve life or education for anyone, but it's a terrible waste of time and energy. Such energy as these rioters and mobsters and destroyers of monuments and desecrators of monuments are using, what if they put that energy into furthering education, like Cecil Rhodes's, or improving job prospects, or encouraging investments in the country? Do you know that unlike modern politicians, Cecil Rhodes never took a salary when he was Prime Minister of the Cape for 6 years, from 1890 through to 1896, he was the Prime Minister of the Cape. He didn't take a penny out of the public treasury because he said, "I don't need it." This, by the way, was the flag of the Cape back in that time. The Cape had a parliament long before there was such a place as Johannesburg or Pretoria. In fact, rather than have the state build him an estate, as ANC President Jacob Zuma did with the infamous Nkandla, in fact, just looking at how the cost of presidents has gone up, it's absolutely berserk. And, of course, right now, who knows how many trillions the corrupt cancer government has stolen. But Cecil John Rhodes built Kurtaskure, now renamed Kronodendal, which he donated to the Cape as a residence for the Prime Minister of the Cape, and with foresight, to the residence of future Prime Ministers of the Union of South Africa, which Cecil Rhodes, of course, had in his mind's eye as a vision for the future. Here's Kurtaskure from the slopes of Table Mountain at that time, and obviously developed a lot since then. The strip of Kurtaskure, absolutely magnificent. You can just see no expenses spared in producing the most magnificent building, and this is what they called the house that Rhodes built. Not that he ever lived in such opulence for long. He spent more time in mud huts and tents and died in a little tin-roofed cottage on the shore. Cecil Rhodes also bought up and ensured the protection of the land on the slopes of Table Mountain, which he donated to the country, to become Newlands Forest. And Newlands Forest is a phenomenal treasury, and what a pleasure to have this so close to the city. How many people in the world have a privilege of having a city that has such a magnificent nature reserve and forest so close? And everyone in Frontline Fellowship and anyone who's done the Great Commission course knows Newlands Forest very well. That's our training ground where we practice and train. And Kirstenbosch Botanical Gardens is another gift by Cecil John Rhodes to the people of the Cape. The most magnificent and rich floral kingdom in the world. I was on a train in England some time ago, and I met, it was on the centenary of the First World War, and I was sitting with a man and around the dining table and asked what work he does, and he says, I work for Q. So I said, Q as in MI6 Q. No, he says, Q, Queen's Gardens. Oh, right. So what do you do there? And, you know, he was obviously bored with this ignorant African who didn't understand what she was up to. And he says, we are obtaining seed from all over the world of every species of plant and keeping them in a vault, properly inventoried, in a nuclear bomb-proof shelter under the Kew Gardens, under Queen's Gardens, in the event of some nuclear catastrophe, so that they can reseed the planet, and so on. And so he that was his particular task. And so I said to him, I live in Cape Town and regularly go to Kirstenbosch Gardens. And his whole face, Kirstenbosch Gardens, just like I've mentioned, the Eldorado of all botanists. And he's like, I just love to go there. And because there's no place on a planet with more species of plants. Europe has got something like 800 species of plants. North America's got something like 1,200. South America's got about 2,000 odd plants. The Cape Peninsula has 2,800 species of flora. And in Kirstenbosch, you can get over 3,000 species of flora if you add in the greenhouses and so on too. It's the richest piece of botanical real estate on the planet. And it's a gift of Cecil Rhodes to our people. And now, with the Boomslang, you can actually get to look down on the birds and their nests and everything from a higher place. And this has been a place of delight for how many people? Kirstenbosch National Gardens. Which other politician has given us anything like this? Ever? And interesting, we even get Kirstenbosch Gardens for the sunset concerts. And I remember when my sister-in-law from Salzburg came here, and we took her to, well, aside from saving the penguins, took her to City Hall, where for the first time in her life she heard the Vienna Boys Choir. She comes from Austria, but she'd never heard the Vienna Boys Choir until she came to Cape Town. And when we went to Kirstenbosch Gardens for sunset, a picnic with the concert there, and she heard Strauss and the Blue Danube, and she said, you people have more culture in Cape Town than we have in Austria. This is just incredible. And, well, again, but look at all that. You know what would have happened if Cecil Rhodes hadn't brought that up and turned it into nature conservation? That should all be built up. You'd just have houses all over the place that would have chopped down a whole lot. Loggers would have taken over. So all of what you see on the slopes of Table Mountain is the gift of forethought. And by the way, in this sense, Cecil Rhodes has something in common with Paul Kruger. The president of the Transvaal, and he saw the need for Sabi Game Reserve, which today is called the Kruger National Park, and also Teddy Roosevelt in America saw the need for Yosemite National Park and so on. So at that turn of the century, there were people looking ahead, seeing, and Kaiser Wilhelm II saw the need for Etosha Game Reserve. So praise God for those visionaries who saw the need to preserve something of the wildlife before it got destroyed by rampant growth. And by the way, while Prime Minister of the Cape, Cecil Rhodes, also ensured that Rondebosch Common be preserved inviolate with no development, building, or anything allowed to be done, but leave it as it is in its natural state in the center of the community. And of course, one of Cecil Rhodes' greatest gifts to the people of Cape Town is the University of Cape Town. And what a magnificent campus. What, I'm not talking about the people or what's been taught in the campus, I'm just talking about the buildings and how it's situated and the view. And if you sat in Jamison Steps and looked out from there, what a magnificent, magnificent view. And he modeled it on Oxford University, but in a much better area. Most significantly, Cecil Rhodes provided for the establishment of the famous Rhodes Scholarships, which he envisaged to render wars impossible and to promote the best interests of humanity. Did you know that was the purpose of the Rhodes Scholarships? In fact, if his vision had been adhered to, the catastrophic First and Second World Wars would have been avoided. It was Cecil Rhodes' vision to unite the British, German, Dutch, and American people through education and student exchange programs for the betterment of humanity and to ensure world peace. And as he said, if we can have the Protestant peoples, the WASPs, not that he used the word WASP, but the Anglo-Saxon peoples, the Germanic peoples, the English, Dutch, German, American, united, he said, there's no power on earth that could possibly wage war against us. And he saw the greatest catastrophe to civilization would be if countries like Germany or Britain ever fought one another. Because they're mighty military people, and neither side would budge, and the result would just be destruction. And so his goal was to see that the Germans, the British, the Americans, and the Dutch be friends, so they never fight one another, and then there would be world peace. And his Rhodes Scholarship, apparently the oldest international fellowship, initiated after his death, based specifically on Oxford, and replicating Oxford University and Rhodes University in Grahamstown and University of Cape Town and so on. Rhodes supported teaching Dutch as well as English in the public schools in the Cape Colony, which for the 1890s was very advanced. He donated money for this cause. As Prime Minister of Cape Colony, he removed the legal discriminations that English speakers before him had imposed on the Dutch-speaking Afrikaners, giving them full equal citizenship rights. He was a friend and supporter of Jan Hofmeyr, the leader of the Afrikanerbond. Here's a monument to Jan Hofmeyr, leader of the Afrikanerbond, just outside of the Moederkerk in downtown Cape Town and not far from Parliament. Cecil Rhodes, you might be surprised to hear, opposed the British annexation of the Transvaal in 1877, which led to the First War of Independence, the First Anglo-Boer War. And he also opposed the British invasion of the Kingdom of Zululand in 1879. He said, Zulus are neighbors, they have not transgressed, this is wrong, this is unjustified. And so you might think of him as some warmongering imperialist, and yet, interestingly enough, he opposed the warmongering imperialists of his day who were interfering with the Transvaal and with Zululand, and he was accused of being unpatriotic as a result while he was Prime Minister of the Cape. So brave moves and out of character of the stereotype. When people have a one-dimensional stereotype, Cecil Rhodes, this sort of thing just doesn't fit the picture, does it? Cecil Rhodes advocated greater self-government for the Cape Colony and for Rhodesia and Australia and Canada and New Zealand, and he opposed interference from London in local affairs. So in this respect, it is inaccurate to call Cecil Rhodes an imperialist. Many people call him the arch-imperialist. In one sense he was, but in the main sense he was not, because he opposed centralized control. He advocated autonomy and decentralization and self-government throughout the British Empire. And so while he wanted to paint the map red, yes, he was devoted to Queen Victoria. He was devoted to the monarchy. But he was scornful and he disdained the politicians in Whitehall, as shown in this cartoon published in his newspaper that he owned in Cape Town. So you can see here's Chamberlain, who's the Secretary of the Colonies, and you notice the waste paper baskets are filled with treaties. You can see how they're rolled up and so on. And they've got these, and he's got these arrogant people around, and Cecil Rhodes plainly doesn't respect them. The way he's standing, propping himself against the table, his hand in his pocket, obviously doesn't exactly want to be there, doesn't trust the people. But this cartoon gives you a bit of the attitude of Cecil Rhodes towards the imperialists in Whitehall. He didn't think any politician in London knew the foggiest of what the right thing to do would be in Rhodesia or Cape Town or Kimberley and so on. And so his outlook towards them was seen in quite a few ways. For example, at one point, his British South Africa police, which was paramilitary, his own private army, you could say, he had ordered them to invade Manicaland and to take over Manicaland, which was under control of Portuguese, which was nice high ground. And that's what today is eastern Zimbabwe. And while they were attacking it, someone came with a telegram from Whitehall that he must cease and desist forthwith and retire from the territory he's taken. And he ordered the man to, he said, you didn't find me, disappear, find me a few days later, ordered another man to go and cut the telegram line to wherever it was coming from, probably Fort Victoria. And he waited until his men assured him they'd taken the highlands, they'd gotten what later was Umtali, what today is Mutari. The whole eastern highlands was in the hands of Portuguese, had the low ground. He had the high ground, and then he allowed them to deliver the telegram, and then he ordered his men to stop because he'd gotten what he wanted. That's the kind of outlook. He did not respect London. He certainly didn't respect the politicians. And in some ways, right here you've got a replica of the Colossus on Rhodes University, on Rhodes Island in the Mediterranean, from where his family got their surname. He wanted to go from Cape to Cairo, and he's got the telegraph line, and obviously he wants the railway. And he was going up, here you can see the high ground of Manicaland around Umtali that his men seized against the express instructions of the British government. And his whole goal, southern Rhodesia, northern Rhodesia, what today is Zambia. And this was a lot of Rhodes' vision. Paint the map red from Cape Town to Cairo, a Cape to Cairo railway line. And by the way, that railway line ends at Simonstown. And from Simonstown all the way up to Cairo became a reality in the next few years. And that's what the British Empire looked like in 1900 when Cecil Rhodes died. And by the way, he wasn't put out that the Kaiser took German East Africa, which was today Tanzania, what then was Tanganyika. That didn't bother him at all because he saw the Germans as allies. It wasn't an obstacle to his goal. And one of his goals, by the way, was to bring America back under the crown. And he wanted to use his immense wealth that he had found in diamonds for that. So Cecil Rhodes' vision, you can see also where the German East Africa, German Southeast Africa was and so on. He saw, well, the Germans and English will make allies. It never crossed his mind that Germany and Britain could be at war in just a few years after he died, because after all, Britain had a German queen in Queen Victoria, and he saw them as their best potential friends, and they've been the best of allies for centuries. So he would have been mortified to know that the Rhodes Scholarship trustees after him excluded the Germans from the scholarship student exchange program, which in his trust, which you can even read at Rhodes College, he had set in. Cecil John Rhodes greatly respected the Germans and admired Kaiser Wilhelm II and gave him a quota of every year how many students he could select from Germany to go to his training programs in Oxford. He provided for German students to be included in the Rhodes Scholarship, although wickedly later governments interfered and stopped that. Notice the Zimbabwe bird in the Rhodes Trust. He believed partnership between the United Kingdom, the United States, and Germany would ensure world peace, and it certainly would have if they'd adhered to it. Here's an interesting book about how the Rhodes Scholars and Oxford created an American elite. Now, unfortunately, it hasn't all gone well, because quite a few of the Rhodes Scholars have become some pretty bad people because they've been hijacked, Oxford University in many ways, by a lot of globalists, and have gone beyond anything he would have planned. But, for example, you can think of some Rhodes Scholars in our lifetime. Obama, Clinton, Kissinger. So he might have had an interesting, noble goal, but a lot of other people hijacked it and took it in another direction later. And so Oxford University, in his mind, the epicenter, the fountainhead of civilization. In 2004, Cecil Rhodes was voted 56th in the SABC television series Great South African. So as recently as 2004, Cecil Rhodes was acknowledged by popular vote as one of the 100 greatest South Africans. Some of Rhodes' quotations seem to have been forgotten. Equal rights for all civilized men. And I could never accept the position if we could disqualify a human being on account of his color. Now they make him out to be some racist and all the rest of it, but he wasn't in his lifetime. In fact, he was seen as the advocate of the Zulu and the Matabele and their friend and the king. What a magnificent university campus. I mean, just what a... Is there a university in the world so well situated in terms of buildings and view and all the rest? And not unusual that you would expect to see a statue of the founder of the university on the campus. So it just so happened that I was there for photo shoot 1st of February, and in 2015, we had just had our march to Parliament on the anniversary of legalization of abortion in the country, and we hired a trailer which had pro-life slogans on the side and pictures, and this is a massive trailer, so I wanted some extra photo shoots, and so while I was waiting for it to come and park just in front of Jamie's steps, and then we'd get a picture of the whole of Table Mountain, Jamison Hall steps of this, with this massive abortion is murder billboard in front of it. So I was amusing myself while I was waiting, and I was asking people who passed by, do you know whose monument this is here? No idea. And I had students passing by, lecturers passing by. Nobody knew whose statue this was. This is 1st of February, 2015. Well, just a few months later, the students are so traumatized, they cannot study on a university campus because there's a statue of the founder of the university who's paying for the education. Can you imagine the audacity of that? And so Roads Must Fall went berserk, literally. And this, I think, became the model for what later happened in Charleston and Ferguson and what's going on in America with BLM. It all seemed to start in Cape Town with this BLM movement. RMF movement, the RMF movement, the Roads Must Fall. And I would have thought students had assignments and work and were there to study, but I was wrong. Apparently there's nothing more important than that they could wrap up in black plastic bags and tape a whole around the statue of the founder of the university. And the idiocy of people going berserk, and I can't even believe that most of these people around were even students in the university. I'm sure a lot of them would just bust in. In fact, the organizers probably were. And would you believe, some people discovered later that there is a link between the monument and the fund that's funding the education. And the statue's gone, but the problems remain. Well, who would have ever guessed that? You know, I would have thought if you could just get rid of a statue that died 100 years ago, that would solve all your problems. But apparently the problems remain. Shame. So those hooligans who attacked and campaigned against monuments of the man who donated the land and provided the money for the University of Cape Town and whose legacy funds education worldwide, they're not only demonstrating their crass ingratitude, but the abject ignorance on the matters that they're demonstrating about. Just look at the thousands of people on there. Is there not some education to do? I mean, don't they have an assignment to you? Which individual has done more for the citizens of Cape Town than Cecil John Rhodes? And I ask this as something of a rhetorical question because I can't think of any individual, let alone politician, who's done anything close to as much of practical good for the people of Cape Town than Cecil Rhodes. I'm not saying that he is a good man, but he is a great man, and what he did benefited Kimberley, Rhodesia, and Cape Town enormously. I mean, just look at all that slope that's been protected from development and where the forests were preserved for so many years. It seems hypocritical to campaign against Cecil John Rhodes, who never took a pound out of the public treasury for himself, but who provided for the education of literally millions over the last century, while ignoring ongoing atrocities and corruptions of blood diamond criminal dictators just across the border like Robert Mugabe and Mnangagwa today. Serious blood diamonds, and if you don't know what we're talking about, you can just see the film Blood Diamonds, and that will put your teeth on edge. But how much corruption is going on in this country? How many billions are stolen by our city council and our government? How much corruption goes on in this country? The looting of Eskom and of SAA and the Postal Service and everything else. Perhaps a more meaningful demonstration, if somebody's really outraged by Cecil Rhodes, the most appropriate thing for those offended by him is to refuse to study on a campus that he provided for or to benefit from any educational trust that he set up and funded. I think that would be an appropriate way of demonstrating against Cecil Rhodes. I will not benefit from something he provided. Now, that would be a protest that would be meaningful. Now, those who live in Cape Town would do themselves a favor by visiting the humble Rhodes Cottage in Muizenberg where Cecil Rhodes died. And the first thing that would strike you is this is the richest man in Africa in his lifetime, and he died in such a humble little house as this, a very humble little house. And to acquaint themselves with some of the legacy of this far-sighted, incredible, influential figure in our history, in this little cottage, the most powerful man in the continent of Africa or in the southern hemisphere died in 1902. And on this table, by the way, they sorted out diamonds in Kimberley. And there's all sorts of intriguing history there and pictures of Rhodes as a young boy. Do you know his father was a minister in the Church of England? He was brought up in the manse, and he was part of a large family. Cecil Rhodes is sitting down here, bottom right, and his mother is on the left there, and these are some of his brothers, sisters, and some aunts. The Kimberley Diamond Mine in 1873, which he, more than anyone else, saw ahead. He arrived as a teenager, as a sickly teenager who wasn't expected to live long, and he saw the need to consolidate the mine works. He organized the first pulley lifts. He recognized a whole lot of things. The amount of innovative things he did to save lives and to make life better for the diggers and for everyone involved, absolutely extraordinary. And Kimberley respects him enormously, as they should. In fact, do you know that before this time, Kimberley was never known as a woman's name, but because the diamond mines came from a place called Kimberley, since then it's become a popular name for women as well. Here's Cecil Rhodes as Prime Minister of the Cape visiting Port Elizabeth, and I don't know if you can see, but he's got a spade in his hand, doubtless inaugurating some new building. The plaque on the Mozambique border, which commemorates the first visit by Cecil Rhodes to the country that would bear his name. He came by port to what is Barra and went inland to get to Rhodesia the first time he went there. Some of his De Beers directors. This is how Cecil Rhodes often lived, in a wagon or in a tent out in the field. This is 1896. In the Matopas, shortly after his Indaba with the Matabele leaders, political supporters in Kimberley in 1898. And it's hard to believe that the man's only in his 40s here. He aged badly early. His health was not good. During the siege of Kimberley in 1899, he stayed in Kimberley. He could have gotten out. He was there the whole time. He was involved in making cannon and doing all sorts of things for the defense of Kimberley during the siege, considered quite a heroic figure at the time. Now, the Matabele, amongst whom I grew up, powerful warriors, Zulu warriors. This is what they looked like when the Rhodesian pioneers arrived in the 1890s. This is photography from the 1890s. And so you can see the state of life and the standard of living. This is now northern Rhodesia on the Kafue River. Some of the interesting hairstyles. Some of these things are coming back now. And how the people were living, and you'll see this is photographic evidence of how the people were and how they were later. Notice the necklaces tight around the necks. I don't know what that must have done, but that must have been a pain in the neck to have those kind of rings around your neck. You can't even take it off at night or anything like that. The big day was in September in 1890 when they raised the British South Africa Company flag, this flag, over what later became Salisbury. And everything had to come up by ox wagon. Hardy people settled this country. It was a wild country, a very wild country. And this is how they began to live at the very beginning. And notice, this is just 1898, just 8 years later, and you can see how Salisbury is being developed. And some seriously good buildings. And that's what it looked like by about 1970, just 8 years later. And they really turned the wilderness into an oasis. Now, again, seeing the state of life of the people living in the country before Rhodes and the pioneers came and brought the gospel, brought in missionaries, and built up. And now you can see the Matabele in organized as part of the police. Just look at the Barotse here with bayonet drill. This is part of the British South Africa Police, which is a paramilitary police in a real sense. And, of course, mounted police. And I remember seeing these scenes when I was in Bulawayo. You can learn from visiting Rhodes Cottage how everything had to come up by wagons at first. And they built some really good buildings. And some of these buildings I still saw in Bulawayo back in the 1970s. And when the railway arrived in 1896 in Bulawayo, and this is 1897. This is just after they'd been in Bulawayo 4 years. And you could see the development building. Again, I remember that building in Bulawayo. And this is pretty close to where I grew up. My home was just over to that side there. And You can see, in fact, here, I would say my home was just to this side here. That's Rhodes's monument, and that's the Maxim gun memorial for the 1896 war. Boulevard part of Main Street. Cecil Rhodes insisted that the streets must be wide enough that you can turn an ox wagon of 16 span oxen around in a street in one go. And that's how wide they are to this day. They built to last, and it brought culture. And 1899, the railway line between Umtali and Salisbury opened with great jubilation. But one of the most spectacular achievements was the bridge over the Zambezi. This is a key part of the Cape to Cairo. Do you know every piece of metal in the bridge was made in England, in Birmingham, and shipped out? And they specified what, and the measurements worked, because they specified at what time in the morning they were to put the last pieces in. Because as the sun rose, it would swell, and then it would fit perfectly. And that bridge still stands today. And this was built in, was it 1903? Very early on. And Cecil Rhodes said, I want the bridge to be close enough that as the people ride across, some of the spray from Victoria Falls will come through the window into their face. And so it does. Just to give you a bit of a feel of the civilization that Cecil Rhodes built in Rhodesia. And these are some of the posters for tourism, encouraging people to come. Of course, tobacco farming was big there. Tanganda tea, we grew up with that. Look at the kind of townships built on the... I remember going in here, outskirts of Bulawayo. Consider the standard and the schools and the standard of living that was uplifted. The people in Rhodesia had some of the highest standards of living. They had some of the finest farms in Africa, second only to South Africa. And the educational standards were even for the people in Rhodesia. You can see here South African flag, where South Africa is donating this ambulance to this particular hospital. But the standard of education, even today, people from Zimbabwe have a higher standard of living than anywhere else in the continent because of the excellent educational base found in Rhodesia. And this Pilo Hospital in Bulawayo, this is the hospital built primarily for black people. Now, there never was apartheid in Rhodesia. There never was white zone or anything like that. But obviously, there were people tend to gravitate to the areas. But there was no segregation in Rhodesia ever. And so, all the same, this hospital was overwhelmingly built for black community. And you can see the standard of living that the people had. And these are pictures taken in the 60s and 70s in Rhodesia. And as for the farming, well, nothing to compare with it anywhere in the world. And throughout Rhodesia, these are some of the books that came out at the time, just showing the kind of lifestyle we lived in Rhodesia, the roads, the strip roads, because so few people, such a big country, just two thin little bits of tar. And if another car's coming, you've got to move your left wheels off, just your right wheel on the left hand strip, and they would do the same, and you'd wave as you passed and go back on. You might go for an hour without seeing another car, though. So, obviously, honouring Cecil Rhodes, honouring Rhodesia, this is part of his vision. And yet, when he died in Muizenberg, what were his last words? So little done, so much to do. Whether we like Rhodes or not, we all benefit from his legacy. If mobs can damage or remove one historic monument, then no monument is safe. And we see this all over the world right now. There's an absolute hysteria of throwing, in this case, the statue of an abolitionist into the water at some place in Britain. Sadly, in Bishop Stortford's museum, they have removed this bust because of some complaints from BLM. Now, has anyone heard of Bishop Stortford, except for the fact that Cecil Rhodes was born and that's where he came from? He's the most famous son of Bishop Stortford. Do you know the people in Wales have actually taken down the statue of Henry Morton Stanley because somebody objected? A man who is acclaimed as the greatest humanitarian in his lifetime for ending slavery in the Congo and all the rest of it. But ignorant mobs, intimidating, and cowards who don't know the history, acquiescing. Apparently, Oxford University's plan to take this plaque down because of objections outside a real college where Cecil Rhodes studied. And who has done more to fund and support Oxford University in the last century than Cecil Rhodes' trust? Downtown, in the gardens, I remember as a new Christian walking the gardens and seeing this sign of Caesarea saying, your hinterland lies there. And of course, he's pointing north. And I felt the conviction, I have to go north with the gospel. Now, of course, that may not have been what he is saying. He is talking about make your future in the north, help civilize the north. Well, the message I got from God is be a missionary to the north. Go north from Cape Town to Cairo. Well, some vandals came with an angle grinder and actually cut into the back of the heel before they were stopped by security, but there was an attempt to even take this down recently. Some years ago, I took this picture, several others, and I wrote a letter which is reproduced in full on the front page of the People's Post complaining about how Sand Parks had allowed a monument to go to ruin and they were not looking after it and litter and when was last cleaned, and this actually led to an improvement in the behavior. And so it just shows we've got to speak up. Even have credit photo Peter Hammond and the article here's virtually everything I wrote to them. I wrote it as a letter editor. I didn't expect to end on the front page, but surprises happen. This is not only about roads, though. This is a battle of a history. By the way, can I just draw your attention to how many trees are on the slopes of the mountain in the past? We have a ministry of deforestation that has gone hysterical, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that millions of trees have been chopped down the Cape Peninsula since 1904. Millions. Used to drive through non-stop forest, trees on both sides, all the way from our airport through Somers West, up the pass, all the way through to not only to Krobo, but all the way through Hohok Pass and down on the way to Hermanus. You'd go through forest. The destruction of trees. And who's getting the money from all that wood? Because the wood is worth a lot of money. We're talking about hundreds of millions of rands worth of wood, if not billions. Who got that? I'm sure that some cabinet minister's cousin got the contract to chop it down, was paid to chop it down. And then who got the money from all the wood once it was sold? I mean, why would you even have to pay someone to chop it down? Because they can get a huge amount of money for the wood. And all this natural heritage that's been chopped down, what's happened to so much of these trees? And who's paid for it? And Constantia, Nick, and all the rest. George Orwell in 1984 warned, the most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their own history. And this is what's being done. This attack on monuments is a war against civilization. And attacks on monuments continue with attacks on churches and then on historic buildings. It's a war against the rule of law. Here's a church that thought putting Black Lives Matter would protect them from getting burned down. It didn't. It's been 7 years since Black Lives Matter was formed. They've raised over $1 billion. They haven't had one neighborhood cleanup. They haven't sent one poor black child to college. They haven't brought school supplies, fed the hungry, or donated to a food bank. They haven't provided housing to one single poor family. Where's the money going? Now it's in billions that they're getting from all over the place. But they can buy these kind of buses to transport their rioters to attack some other community. Now, this is CCCP, that's what the USSR in the Soviet Cyrillic script. So that's the Soviet Union's emblem, the ham and sickle, the star, the fist. That's Occupy Together, that's the Black Lives Matter symbol. It kind of looks like they're related. Now, if the Antifa and BLM mob get the kind of government they want, none of them would be allowed to protest. You're not allowed to protest in communist countries. And so this is the funny thing. Have they thought about the fact that if they get what they want, you're not allowed to protest in Zimbabwe and so on. They just shoot you. This is Cape Town. If they don't stop with monuments, they attack everything. Police stations, churches, forests, Lion's Head, arson, people's homes. This is the result of if you allow people to damage any property, no property is saved. That is why I love this painting from Lausanne in Switzerland, of Lady Justice. She's unblindfolded, unlike the American Lady Justice, always blindfolded. The European Lady of Justice never is blindfolded. The eyes are wide open, holding the scales of justice, weighing the evidence. And the sword of justice pointed to an open book which has written on it, Holy Bible. And the magistrates of the city are looking up to the principles of justice, and above it is written, Justice lifts the nations. And the people are arguing over their cases, and there's the sheriff of the court standing with his long sword, double-handed sword, in front, ready to administer justice on the words of the appointed magistrates who are looking to justice for the principals. This is a war against education itself. One of my classic quotes that we got from one of these BLM Antifa characters destroying a monument was, but this was a monument to an abolitionist. What's an abolitionist? This is why it's so important to know a history, and why I've written Sketches from South African History, which has been expanded and translated into Sketse uit die Suid-Afrikaanse Geskiedenis. We've got audio MP3s on this. It's important that you know own history. 1 Corinthians 10, 6-11 says, now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted. Now all these things happened to him as examples, and they were written for our admonition. Reformer John Calvin declared, histories are a true school for learning how to order our lives. History tells us what has worked and what has not worked. And we need to develop the ability to recognize these lessons in every area of life. We need to discover the roots, our roots, and know that everything has consequences. History illustrates the consequences of ideas and of actions. Everything has consequences. In history, we can see examples of man's depravity and rebellion against God, and we can see illustrations of God's mercy and grace and sovereignty and intervening in the course of human events. History is and must ever continue to be, next to God's word, the richest foundation of wisdom and the surest guide to all successful practical activity. History can provide us with the visions of those who impacted their society, who refused to bow the knee and to mouth Caesar's Lord or Black Lives Matter or whatever the new mantra is. And examples of excellence to inspire us to courageously stand firm in spite of all opposition. We will not bow, we will not bend, we will not burn, could say Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We need to learn from positive godly role models, examples of excellence who can inspire us to reach higher, go further, never give up, achieve more through the collective wisdom of the past. That's what history is. We also need to learn from the mistakes of others to benefit from the painstaking developments and sacrifices of our fathers in the faith. To be ignorant of what happened before you were born is to remain a child forever, said Cicero. In history we can find encouragement to persevere, a rebuke to short-sightedness and selfishness. We can learn in history lessons to expose false doctrines and to correct unwise policies. History can teach us humility as we consider the great sacrifices that others have made for many of the privileges we enjoy today and probably take for granted. History can put our trials and troubles into perspective. We must learn from history or we will repeat its mistakes. If we do not know our own history, we will simply have to endure all the same mistakes, sacrifices and absurdities all over again. Real history, told from a biblical perspective, is a treasure of the church that can teach us the truth that endured. In the scripture, we command to understand the times, that God's people might know what they ought to do. That's from 1 Corinthians 12, 32. Understand the times. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat the past. The longer you look back, the further you can look forward. A tall building needs to lay deep foundations. A tall tree needs a deep root system. Let's say, if you go to some of these big old trees in Kirstenbosch Gardens, some of those trees may have as much as 1 million leaves and a mile of roots. Some of those big old trees. To understand who you are, you need to understand where you came from. We need to understand the events and the issues of the past that correspond with our challenges today. Human nature hasn't changed much. We can learn a lot from the past. In order to anticipate problems and threats in the future, we need to study our past. To liberate our thinking from current fashions and to recognize potential potholes and traps. There's nothing mobs respect more than strength. There's nothing they despise more than weakness. There's some things you can learn. Communists never tell the truth and they never see the need to keep their promises. Treaties are like pie crust, made to be broken. To tell the truth is a petty bourgeois habit, but to lie and to lie convincingly is a sign of superior intelligence. Quote unquote from Vladimir Lenin. We will find immeasurable insights and practical help from studying the people and the events and the issues that shaped our past and which affect our present situation. As Professor C.S. Lewis declared. It's not the remembered past. It's the forgotten past that enslaves us. You hear people saying we're enslaved by history. Well, it's the forgotten history that enslaves us, not the remembered. Christianity is rooted in history. Much of the Bible is actually history. Some of the key doctrines of Scripture are linked to historic events recorded in Scripture. Creation, fall, flood, Babel, Exodus, fall of Jerusalem, exile to Babylon, return of the exiles, incarnation of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ, his resurrection, his ascension. These are all historic events. Hebrews 11, the Hall of Faith, focuses on historic personalities as examples of excellence to inspire and guide us. Unlike Eastern religions, which have a circular view of history, reincarnation, where they cannot even distinguish in Hindi, for example, from present, past, and future, because past and future, it's all, you know, it's all one big cycle. We believe in a linear view in history. You only have one life, it'll soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. History is heading towards a climactic conclusion, the fulfillment of the Great Commission, the return of Christ, the day of judgment of both the living and the dead. And because of the importance of history, manuscript research, archaeology is important. The Apostle Paul warns brethren not to be ignorant of the lessons of history, 1 Corinthians 10. The Apostles' Creed focuses on the historic roots of our faith. It doesn't say anything about the teachings of Christ. It's all about the history, the life of Christ. Apostles' Creed is all history. When the Gospel is summarized in 1 Corinthians 15, it's focused on historic events. Stephen's defense of the faith in Acts 7 is a lesson in redemptive history. History is his story. All nations will come and worship before you. Luke, who authored the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts, was a meticulous historian, one of the finest historians. This is how he begins his book. Inasmuch as many have taken the hand to set in order a narrative of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered to them, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write you an orderly account, that you may know the certainty of those things. The kingdoms of the world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. So that's why I've been writing history books, in many cases made up the chapters of different presentations that first were given at the Reformation Society, and many Reformation Society lectures end up as chapters and books and as audio parts and MP3s in order for us to have ammunition to use in the fight, because when you know your history, you cannot be guilt manipulated or fooled by Marxists. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. One of the great resources that you can get, aside from the history books that we've got here, is Agenda 2, Masters of Deceit. And it speaks about their attempt to change history, to change textbooks, and to brainwash people in schools and through Hollywood and through the news media, and how important it is to understand the communist agenda. So, any comments, questions? Yes, Belinda. Yes, for some reason, Americans are obsessed with the fact that their lady justice must be blindfolded. That is not something you see in Europe. At least all the places I've been in Europe, and I've been to a good 20-something countries in Europe, and all the justice statues that I've seen in Europe, no blindfold. All the statues in America, they've always got a blindfold.
Do you have any idea why they wear a
blindfold? Well, what the Americans are trying to say is that Lady Justice blind as to your status, your class, your color, your creed, or whatever it is, and you get justice. But I find hard to think how you can see all the facts and weigh the evidence if you're not having the blindfold removed and you can see clearly. So I understand where they're coming from, but I identify with the European rather than the American concept of Lady Justice. And I just love that painting in Lausanne in Switzerland, you know, where Lady Justice holding the scales and pointing the sword down to the Holy Scriptures. In many places, like in America, you see the swords lifted upright, pointing upright, and so is the scale, so it's almost equal. But I think the one in Switzerland looks to me the most biblical. You understand that they mean well in what they're saying, blindfolded justice, but It's just uncanny. I've never seen a blindfolded justice statue in Europe. And I've been outside the Old Bailey, for example, in London, Switzerland, Germany, all over. And no blindfolds on justice in Europe and blindfolds on all of them in America. I don't know if there's a story in there somewhere, but I've got some pictures of Rhodesia in the background just while we're having questions. Questions, comments?
Why is
he hated so much? Well, I think he's become a caricature. So, first of all, a lot of people blame him for the Anglo-Boer War, which isn't really fair, because he opposed the first one, and while he is seen as having contributed to the second, he didn't really. That was very much Lord Milner's doing, and Milner, whose name graces the road that we just went down to come here, Milner is definitely one to blame, and I would have thought that Chamberlain in England and Kitchener, who oversaw all of the Scorched Earth campaigns in South Africa, you know, they're some people to blame. But Lord Milner was the High Commissioner here in South Africa, and he was the one who directly actually declared war. But Cecil Rhodes has gotten the blame for a lot of what others did, and I don't think many understand the fact of just what an ally of the Afrikaner he was in the Cape Parliament in particular, and how much he actually did for the people. But for many people, a caricature, he's an imperialist, he's a colonialist, he's a racist, even though there's no evidence in his life that he was. But this is how he's been caricatured. And there's a lot of people who've been caricatured and things like that. Like, I remember hearing people say that Ian Smith, the most hated man in Africa, dinosaur of apartheid. And yet I saw he was beloved by the people in Zimbabwe, both Shona and Madibili. And he, in fact, rejected apartheid. Totally, never applied. But this is the caricatures. The caricatures often outweigh the evidence. Very strange. I thought Cecil Rhodes was a bad person too, because that's what I received as a youngster. But as I've looked into it over the years, I've moved from having had a fairly negative view of Cecil Rhodes to having an overwhelmingly more positive view. Not that, look, I wish he'd put all that energy into the kingdom of God, but he still came from a biblical worldview, from a Christian pastoral family, and he certainly was working for civilization and education. If he had had that regenerate gospel outlook, how much more he would have achieved. But he did achieve a lot in terms of civilization and in terms of conservation in the Western Cape. He certainly achieved a lot. If he'd been regenerate, how much more would he have achieved? Other comments? Yes, in fact, Gabriel has a lot of insight into this because he's the one who first found the head that had of being decapitated. But Gabriel, you want to add insights, please?
When, you know, like, hello, how can you reinvent? Not so much really. I think everybody was taken a bit of surprise by the statue being taken off the campus for its own good, you know, for safekeeping. But now, no one really saw that coming. I think a lot of people who thought that you know, truth will prevail were somewhat ambushed by a very sinister you know, Iqbal survey. It all started off with he went to his daughter's graduation and the ex-editor of Cape Times that he fired gave the keynote speaker, and Iqbal had an in for UCT from that day on. It just seems like the media is very biased, and it seems like they use incredible, you know, means of is it actually in the media is owned by a cover of left wing? Is it, you know, are we dealing with I was rescued from a mob outside Bremner, because I said, you know, Mugabe said Cecil will come again, basically. I was dragged from Bremner to Japonica. And I turned around the guy who was dragging me, and I said, well, where are you from? He says, no, I'm from National Intelligence. But don't you think a lot of this is all quite orchestrated?
Oh, yes.
It's very deliberate, and it spreads like fire, and I think it's almost as if there's quite a bit of money and interest to destabilize, you know, civilized values. And is there any way of actually, we were all pretty much ambushed by the speed that this media just somehow brainwashed everybody, or made everybody feel scared and intimidated. And surely this is like what happened in like Meshach, Meshach and Abednego, the same things of everybody must worship this God.
Bow down.
But like we'll stand, keep on standing. And it seems like the whole of the media is basically insinuating that everybody's taking the knee, everybody's mass indoctrinated. And how can one actually fight against this nonsense?
Only with knowledge and education, because I'm sure the main goal here is distraction. While the government loots the country, distract the people, and blame it on somebody who died 100 years ago, or in the case of Yantran Rebic, 300 years ago, and if the people can channel their energies, it looks to me like George Orwell, 1984, 2 minute hate and hate week. In fact, you first see it starts with 2 minute hate and then builds up, and suddenly you have a hate week where you redirect everyone's hostility to this real or imagined enemy. And that distracts everyone from what the state's doing and looting, stealing, oppressing, and so on.
But how do you stand up to the state week?
We've got to just use information. So, obviously, what's our weapons? Truth, light, books, leaflets, newspapers, letters to editor, radio programs, presentations, these days social media. We've got to hope and pray that ultimately truth will prevail. Initially, the mob hysteria will prevail. But in time, surely people have to be disillusioned, like those people in that article saying, the statue's removed, but the problems remain. Yeah. I mean, who would have guessed?
Black Lives Matter, it's almost as if they're the same territory.
I think they work on the same script. They've probably got the same puppet masters behind them.
But I think, as with ISIS that passed, I mean, maybe this too will pass.
Trouble is, in the meantime, they do a lot of damage.
Yeah.
And so prevention is better than cure, obviously. So for people to know their history now, I was brought up in a society where, for example, I don't know what would have happened if someone had, if any of us had been rude to an elder or damaged some property, because unthinkable. For example, in Rhodesia, we had corporal punishment. And corporal punishment was serious corporal punishment. I mean, they would have someone apply a cane, and there would be a scar for life. They applied so, but the kids did not vandalize and cause problems as a result, because we had corporal punishment at school. We had corporal punishment. I only felt the cane once in my life, and that's when I set the mice free from the biology experiment. But aside from that, I was a goody who never did anything wrong. My brother went to the principal's office quite a few times, but. The thing is, being brought up with discipline, they taught us respect for property, respect for elders. One of the things in our schools in Rhodesia that we were taught is respect for women. So, as an all-boys school, you tipped your hat for any lady of any age, even if she's in primary school and you're in high school. And you give your seats to a woman of any age and so on and so forth. And you're always walking outside, not inside. You've got to be protective. They taught us how to be gentle. You never have your hands in your pocket, unless you're going to pull out a handkerchief or comb or pen instantly. Having your hands in your pockets was a caneable offense. And the standards of discipline that we were taught was so good. And the whole of society was disciplined. If you didn't get disciplined at home, you certainly got it at school. If you didn't get it at school, you'd get it from the society, from the police, and then you'd get the army. So we learned discipline many levels. But today, where are the youngsters getting discipline? I mean, it's not even an average home. It's an unusual home where there's discipline. There's not even church discipline in many places. So in a society, you can see now, you lock everyone up, you frustrate them, and then you let them be unleashed for mob anarchy as a result of real or imagined or exaggerated or stage-managed events. And next thing, they're looting and causing billions of dollars of damage in American streets. To me, this is as orchestrated as it comes. And there's a whole lot of people benefiting by distracting folks from the real issues. Of course, in America, it's probably about an election. Down here, it's probably about looting.
Now,
other observations?
Huge corporations giving millions of dollars to, like, the whole thing about, like, Facebook, the Coca-Cola, Nike, through their advertising from Facebook until they said, oh, well, we're going to take all the right-wing organizations and criticism out of Facebook. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're going to basically embargo Facebook, and they,
yes.
But you see, this is an indoctrination, and it's a quite a poison indoctrination of that any form of criticism, if you know, is bad.
Yes. It's quite brilliant what they've done, but I see why they've done it. It's because in 2016, Brexit and the Trump revolution happened as a result of social media. All the controlled mass media was anti-Brexit and anti-Trump, but they lost in both Britain and America as a result of social media. And social media was just meant to be for entertainment, for frivolous, you know, this is a picture of the meal I had for lunch. It's not meant to be something serious, and the people have used for evangelism and political getting around the propaganda. You can see that there's been a real hostility now. And so that's why since 2016, there's been this move of we've got to censor and control Facebook and other social media. It's because of Brexit and Trump's victory that they're trying to censor it, because before that, they controlled the media, and now they found there's this gap through which alternative opinions being spread.
Social media got a ban, and social media got kind of Trump. I don't know. It's incredible how the world's changed with the same.
Well, Obama had the mass media on his side. He had the mainstream media. Social media was a trivial part of it compared. I mean, he had CNN, CBS, ABC, the whole lot, Slime magazine. Useless News and World Report.
Why did he die so young?
Sorry?
Why did he die so young?
Cecil Rhodes. He had tuberculosis, amongst other things. He actually died of a heart attack. But he had lung problems, and he had a weak heart. But I think he had a plethora of problems. He was not healthy. They said he was going to die in England. His studies were interrupted. He was sent out to be on a farm in Natal, because said the healthy climate there would help. And when he arrived, the diamond rush started, and he left the farm, dashed up to Kimberley, and before you knew it, he was a teenager when he got to the diamond digs, what they called New Rush, what today is Kimberley. And the fact that he had the insight to see what the others didn't see, and then he brought them all out one after the other. Brilliant, brilliant man. Absolutely extraordinary what he managed to achieve. But yes, when he got on the ship, his family didn't think he'd arrive in Durban alive. So he lived longer than he should have. I should just make a comment. This Saturday we've got our first biblical interpretation course since the lockdown. Starting here, Hunter's going to be running it on biblical exposition and so on. Yes, Anita.
Did his bursary fall away now that they've pulled down his statues?
Oh, I wish. I doubt it. Unfortunately, the people running the trust today, I don't know if there's backbone or if it's been totally hijacked by the wrong people by now. I suspect so. I think that right now the Rhodes Trust is in the hands of people who have globalists. Certainly, they've been producing globalists lately. His vision was a good vision, the way it's put out in his trust. But what's been going on, if they can produce people like Kissinger and Clinton, then...
Is that all Rhodes? Is everybody a Rhodes thing at Oxford?
No, but he's certainly got the biggest, most worldwide. For example, every year you get two students who get a Rhodes Scholarship from every one of the 50 states in the United States. I forget how many comes from South Africa, Australia, Canada and so on, but I know that they had that much. So America gets 100 Rhodes Scholars a year, and they go to Oxford for 2 years full paid scholarship. So there's hundreds of Rhodes Scholars from all over. And apparently, since the Mandela Rhodes Trust, since 1994, so there hasn't been a white Rhodes Scholar from South Africa. So much for no Calabar. Right now it's rigged. I think the government runs it here, and they shouldn't. No government should be deciding who goes on a Rhodes Scholarship, but somehow or another they've interfered with. Gabriel, do you know how the Rhodes Scholarship works in South Africa now, or anything like that?
Sacks have got two Rhodes Scholarships. Sacks, bishops, and four of us. They have two each.
So does the school choose who goes from this school?
I believe so, but I mean, as you say, recently there's been a they're trying to desperately revamp into dysfunctionality. I mean, the whole Rhodes Scholars. But I mean, now, I mean, even in the early days, there were a lot of black Rhodes Scholars.
Oh yeah, always.
And they were all very mixed.
Yes, but there were some whites.
I think, you know, in a way, that's why Rhodes is like legacies, is education. I know even my right-hand man is a Zimbabwean Rhodesian, and he said even with Mugabe, they said even Mugabe continued the high level of education.
The foundation was good.
They couldn't fault Mugabe on the education. They made sure that the education...
They just couldn't get jobs once they came out with the
qualifications. That's very sad. But I think South Africans have been hugely blessed by Zimbabwe. The value of... the quality of education, I think South Africans... as you said, to Zimbabwe, yeah. The flow of what Zimbabweans have brought into the country as well. And also attitudes.
Well, I've heard from even South Africans that while Rhodesia might have been second only to South Africa agriculturally, Rhodesia had the highest standard of education in the continent.
Definitely, yeah.
When I came down from Rhodesia, I was actually surprised that I found myself ahead of others in my class, my grade, which wasn't good for me because it meant I could coast. I didn't push myself as much as I would have had to up there. And I went to a good school down here, but really it was like, aside from Afrikaans, I was ahead of the other students.
But I think apartheid didn't exist as much there as in South Africa.
Not
I
at all.
Foster went in Smith to go to the South African race for arms.
Ian Smith said he was told straight out, if you don't implement apartheid, we'll stop giving you aid. Trade. He documents that in his book, Great Betrayal. So you all know that the head was stolen, knocked off, and interestingly enough, Gabriel's the one who found it, following the trail, and was down at the base, and the police didn't find it.
It was absolutely amateur. Amy and I saw, we were coming back from Prager Rolls at Silverwood. And I saw these two lights at Rhodes Memorial at about 8 on a Saturday. And then the following, Monday morning, I got this image of, you know, Rhodes itself. But before that, since 2015, someone cut the nose off, and it took the sandparks 2 years to do nothing.
Yeah.
So one morning I woke up thinking, today's the day, and I remodeled the nose, and I made it out of plastic. So it was a cat and mouse game for about for a good 5 years. But in about August last year, they had got an angle grinder. And they always cut the nose off. They didn't smash the nose off that I put on. And then August about, they made an angle grinder on the neck. And I knew it was a question of time when they'd take the head off. And I struggled because it's a huge 164 wide by 190 high, and it's hugely cast. But I knew I was fighting against time, and at some stage we kind of molded the head, and it was with plasticine. And then the next is I saw, unfortunately, someone beating me to it, not realizing that we should have just scanned it. We should have scanned the head and the because now you can actually remake these. So what we were thinking about doing basically when the head went off was, you know what, we're going to make about 10 or 20 of these Rhodes sculptures and put them all around Cape Town. So if you chop off the head of the one
Hydra
sculpture, we're like, you'll unleash more sculptures. Rather than feeling, oh gosh, the chap's been decapitated. No, it's just actually multiplies. It completely throws off the sense of tragedy. But unfortunately, on the Wednesday, I went there about half past four, and I walked down where I saw the light. And just below the, where the wall is, there was a big hole. So what they did was obviously they cut the head off, carried it, just threw it over the pediment, and then they threw it into the bush. So I could actually see the, I'm no loose scar, but I could actually see that the bush had been broken. And I know, why would the bush be broken? And then I followed, and within 2 or 3 meters, I got the head. That's a big thing, weighs a ton, and I should have, in retrospect, it was about 5, almost after 5, they closed the gate at 6, and I was going to come round the next morning with my mishak. And then I had unfortunately told the restaurant owner, the head's there. And unfortunately, he had tipped off the sandparks people. But had I had the head in my possession, I would be welded back on.
Yes.
But it, you know what? It's good things come out of tragedies sometimes. The fact is that we've got the sculpture scan. We've formed the Friends of Rose Memorial. We've gone from Sam Park, they haven't responded. Now we're going to Sara. They don't respond. We just got to go up and up and up.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, sometimes good enemies make you a better person.
Yes.
I'm a tougher person, and so our next step is to, for Heritage Day, we're trying to actually put another replica head on the But it's interesting to see. I mean, I spent a lot of time then. 99% of everybody think, wow, that's amazing guy. But you get the office and think, that man there killed more people than Hitler and Stalin put together.
I think they failed at maths.
Yeah.
No, but you hear them saying the same thing of Christopher Columbus. So these are the notes of tonight's presentation. Went down there. Text, yes.
Sorry, I've got a question as well. So what exactly do same in South Africa, same in the USA, kind of cross with the world? Because I've tried to put myself in their shoes, but I can't work it out. So what exactly do they want by changing a name or destroying a building or a statue? What is their objective?
Oh!
Like, how do they just...
It's serious. No, this is vital part of revolution.
Because it's happening in Stellenbosch as well now where they want to change...
Of course.
The lecture halls,
no. It's
the
revolution.
That name.
You look at the French Revolution, one of the first things they start to do is pull down statues. Second thing they start to do is guillotine people. Changing the names of every road they can, changing the names of the buildings. In France, they went so far as to change the calendar. They changed the names of every month of the year. They changed the 7-day week into a 10-day week. They started year one, was in September 1793. Or was 792, they started year one, and so they start a new calendar. And Russia, Bolshevik Revolution, also tried a 10-day week, by the way. And they try to change everything they can. This is part of revolution. The best way to destroy people, change your history. And 1984 shows that the Ministry of Truth deals with lies, rewrites history, rewrites textbooks, and they vaporize people that they don't like and make them unpersons, and they disappear down a memory hole. And this is how you rebuild. If for them, as Karl Marx said, new gods need to be installed. We've got to pull down all the old heroes of the country and of the culture and replace them with new gods and new heroes. And so they've got to pull down real heroes to put up their fake heroes. They've got to pull down the real god to lift up their false god and their idols. So this is revolution. It's also psychological warfare. So what they're doing is they're trying to rip out of your heart and soul everything important in your culture. And some people may not even know why it's important in our culture. For example, sad to say from my side, I didn't know or appreciate the importance of the Ascension in our calendar when it was a public holiday. Only when Mandela cancelled Ascension Day as a public holiday, and the next year, 1995, we didn't have Ascension Day, and I was asked by a church in the Cape Flats to come and speak on Ascension Day and its importance. And I had to actually go to the Bible and study it because I had not appreciated the importance of the Ascension, that it's all about authority and the Great Commission. And Jesus above all authority and powers and principalities. And he's coming again to judge the living dead. So Christmas deals with the incarnation. Good Friday deals with the atonement. Resurrection Sunday deals with the resurrection of Christ. Ascension deals with the authority of Christ and the Great Commission. That's a very important part of this. For us to take the Ascension out of our calendar, we've lost it. And of course, Pentecost Sunday is really important. And Reformation Day is really important. So our calendar is being interfered with, just for starters. Now, Workers' Day, Women's Day, Human Rights Day, Freedom Day. Oh, well, I don't think that's a public holiday yet. But I mean, what are those? They're secular humanist days. And what are they replacing? Christian holidays like Ascension Day. Ascension Day is still a public holiday in at least 26 countries in the world that I've noticed. Like Austria and Germany. It's still a public holiday there, but they've taken away as a public holiday here. And so sometimes we've got to lose something like our Sabbath laws. We used to have laws against Sabbath desecration. Everything was shut on Sundays. Only churches were open. Business was shut. No cinemas on Sundays and so on. I got converted that way. I came from Rhodesia and I went to a cinema on a Sunday expecting to see a film, but no cinemas were open in 1977 in South Africa. But the local church had taken over the cinema in God's providence, and I didn't know that, and I walked into a trap. As a secular person from a secular family who had never been to church in my life, I walked into a cinema expecting to see a film on a Sunday, and I got the gospel. And it changed my life forever. So most people in South Africa thought Sabbath laws were a pain, an inconvenience. You know, who's the government to tell us what we can and can't do on Sundays? Grumbling. And, well, now we know. Churches had to close because they couldn't get to church on Sunday. You've got, because of all the traffic. In fact, we're told that there's more business done in the average shopping centre before lockdown on a Sunday than there would be even on a Saturday. And there were whole churches that literally had to sell up their church and move away because they couldn't continue to operate in a CBD like Claremont. Claremont Baptist, for example, they just had to move because of the traffic jams there around Cavendish Square on a Sunday. Now, a lot of the things, people used to complain about the censorship bureau in this country. I grew up never hearing swearing, seeing anything vaguely pornographic, never hearing anything. I didn't know there was such a thing as a homosexual until I was in my 20s. So, you know, really, I didn't know of the existence of pornography until I was 26. I was protected. We had, in Rhodesia and South Africa, strict censorship. They censored everything out. I could see a film, like Dirty Harry, and not know that in the original film there was swearing or anything else because our censors snipped all that out, which made them better. And then all these people grumbling and that, all of South Africa grumbling, oh, the censorship bureau or the Publications Control Bureau was protecting us from the filth and degeneracy of overseas. And so South Africa today is very different from the South Africa I grew up in. I grew up in a society where we didn't need locks and keys and all that sort of thing and never got locked out of home because the front door was never locked, and if it ever was, you went the back door, which was never locked. So there was no burglar bars in the windows. I was brought up in a society where you could go to church any time, day or night, and if the church, especially Anglican church, would be open. You could go inside. There's valuable things that nobody would dream of stealing from church. Now, I grew up in a society so totally different from what my children have to grow up in because they wrecked all that. And, of course, they demonized the people who gave us a Christian civilization so that people would be willing to accept a communist, socialist, Marxist, atheist, anti-God system. And if you ever question it, you're a racist, bigot, and so on. And they've got to keep you on with all this and distract their supporters by attacking all of these monuments on while they're looting billions out of the country's treasury. So you can see it makes sense if you understand revolutions. Every single communist revolution does the same. They rip down all the old monuments. They tear up the old textbooks. They change the curriculum. They change all the names. They change the holidays. They change the culture. They change the music. Everything. They have to. That's what revolution is all about. If they fail to do it, there'll be a counter-revolution from evil people like me, who are reactionaries and counter-revolutionaries, who work against the revolution. So that's the whole thing. This script has been played over and over since 1789. It's the French Revolution, Bolshevik Revolution, Cambodian Revolution, Zimbabwe Revolution. Revolutions come to America. It's come to South Africa.
What would you call the revolution now?
Communist Revolution. Same thing. Of course, there's phases. There's first phase, there's second phase. First phase is political control. Second phase is cultural economic and every other kind of control. So what they're busy with right now in South Africa is the second phase of the revolution. America's still getting the first phase of the revolution. They're still after political control. But I'd say everything in America right now is about the election and gaining control of the White House. And in our country, it's about distracting us from the looting of the criminal mafia class that call themselves the government in this country. Whenever you write ANC, put ANC in capitals and put a small C in front of it and a small ER after it. Cancer. It's a cancer government. A cancer is a cell that doesn't contribute to the health of the body. It breaks down the body. So when I refer to government, I refer to the small C, capital ANC, small ER government. And after a while, people just have to speak about the cancer and you all know what you're talking about. ANC, abortion, nepotism, corruption. I think Babel's the inspiration. And as you see, the EU built their whole parliament in the shape of Tower of Babel, incomplete, with the scaffolding on the outside. And just in case you missed it, they put a woman riding a beast monument outside it, and then they put as their slogan, Europe, many tongues, one voice. Yeah. It's just Babel, fist of rebellion, God's face. The EU is as antichrist as it comes. And that's why all the Christians in Eastern Europe are outraged. They're the ones resisting. So, knowing a history, it irritates them. Yes, you can switch it off. Knowing a history is so key, and it frustrates the enemy. The enemy wants us to forget our history and to accept their history. That's why they want you to accept Mandela Day. Forget the fact he legalized abortion. Forget the fact that he legalized pornography, prostitution, gambling, and all these other things. And that he's a communist and that he blew people up and incinerated people and, Joburg station bombing and so on, killed a grandmother and incinerated and burnt the life of some poor granddaughter of hers. Yeah, don't worry about that stuff, you know. The important thing is he's your new God and he's, like, perfect. And any criticism proves that you're racist, bigot, counter-revolutionary, something. And so you need your new days. And so what have you done for your 67 months on Mandela Day? And so this is like a new religion, and BLM's a new religion. There's no atonement, but there's got to be perpetual repentance for original sin of being straight or white or male. And if you're a black straight male, two strikes against you. You're a white straight female, two strikes against you. If you're a white straight male, three strikes against you. And this is original sin, and you need perpetual repentance. Kneel down, repeat these things after me, raise your fist, and so on and so forth. Wash these feet, and so on. They've got their religious ceremonies. Not that you will ever get forgiveness for it, but there's perpetual repentance for perpetual sin. And they've got their religious ceremonies and all sorts of things. You've got to break windows, you've got to smash things, you've got to pull down monuments. The whole thing is a religious cult. Because a cult says there's only one way of salvation. If you don't do it exactly our way, you're not saved. And that's what BLM is, and Antifa and so on. You've got to do exactly this way or you are not saved. And you've got to be, you may not be one of us, but you can be an ally if you give enough money and things like this. And we've got them here. Right now, the Land Party is completely run and orchestrated by some white woman in Hermanus. And BLM in America is completely rigged by these whiteies, and there's 70% of any BLM mob in America. Look at the pictures. They're whites. Black Lives Matter is a white-run organization, so they're just using black people as a front. And when you speak to any of these people, as I have, and you say, but Thomas Sowell or Walter Williams or Ben Carson, they're not black. Ben Carson and Walter Williams is not black. No. Thomas Sowell's not black. No, he isn't. What about Clinton? No, well, Clinton's black. What? Hillary or Bill? Both of them. But Ben Carson's not black. No, he's not. Right here, I've been told by people in this country that Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi is not black. He's not? Related to Shaka, for goodness sakes. You know, how's he not black? No, because he's not communist. I mean, he's not supporting that, therefore he's not black. So it's not even about race when you get down to it. The race is the pretext. But behind it, it's actually just communism. See the logos they've got there. They make it quite clear. This is all about revolution.
I was listening to John MacArthur last night on the LN, and an interesting thing that he said, and I agree with him, is that it's absolutely designed by Satan, the LN. That was what he's actually pointed out at the end of the of his office sermon.
If I get a chance to counter graffiti, take BLM, Baal, Lucifer, Moloch, or burn, loot, murder, BLM. We used to do this for when counter graffiti, they would come in and paint on their bridges, A and C, with spray paint, red, go and red, add. So maybe theirs wasn't red and red, and have black spray paint letters often, and put A and C. So it's anarchy or arson, necklacing, and communism. Of course, more recently, because they used to have the ECC, that's End Conscription Campaign. We'd go and counter it with Every Coward's Choice. And they had UDF. UDF was the front for the ANC, now I'm going back to the 80s. But Uni Royal Dunlop Firestone.
Because
they were using necklace moves at that time, so Uni Royal Dunlop Firestone. So, I mean, this is the kind of, it's dominate the landscape. Now you can do it in social media with memes and so on, but at that stage it was a graffiti war that was being waged. And they, when Tutu became Archbishop, Archheretic, and moved into Bishop's Court, somebody, I don't know who actually, painted Route AK-47, Tutu Letu, on the side of the wall there, Route AK-47. There's some clever ways that you can get back at him, and when you use humour, people remember it.
Have you heard of Black Olives Matter?
No?
Put the O in front of the L.
Black Olives Matter.
Oh, you just put an O in front of the L. Well, we've got coming up in under a month, on the 4th of, not exactly a month, on the 4th of October, will be International Life Change Sunday. And we're wanting to design a new poster, challenge to any artists here, Babies Lives Matter. On the Babies Lives Matter side. Now, maybe it should be a fully black poster with white lettering on. It's got to look as close to theirs as possible. But Babies Lives Matter. We've got a lot of other good ones out there. By the way, somebody got arrested in America for putting in chalk outside of Planned Parenthood. Black Babies Lives Matter. And they arrested him in chalk. You could paint on the main street Black Lives Matter, but you couldn't outside an abortion clinic. Put in chalk, Black Babies Lives Matter. And a whole lot of police, multiple vehicles came and arrested these poor pro-lifers. It's bizarre. There were black pro-lifers arrested outside Planned Parenthood for making a stand for the right to life of babies in black neighborhoods, and the police arrested them. While down other side of town, there were BLMs looting, burning, stealing, and the police were doing nothing. I mean, it just shows it's insane. And that happens in Democrat-run cities. But we see it here too, because you could have looting going on some places, burning of vehicles on the N2, but when the restauranteurs and the hospitality industry march to Parliament, they get hit with water cannon, tear gas and stun grenades. You can say?
Do they know who's behind? Are they aware? Are they investigating who's behind
BLM?
BLM and Antifa and all these guys? Because,
yes.
I mean, I think I know who he is, but I mean...
Well, George Soros is the money.
Yeah.
He funds it.
But I mean, are they going to nail him?
Do you know that George Soros is even interested in South Africa, even in Cape Town? He's put money into political groups.
But he was, here, here just before the lockdown. He was here George with
Soros.
Bill Gates and Rockefeller.
I didn't know that. I know that Bill Gates has visited Cape Town before. I didn't know George Soros has. But I know that they put
but
money in.
He had tea with Helen Ziller.
Oh my. Well,
I'm
I don't know anything about that,
sure.
But if you could send me a link, I'd be interested. Fascinating.